You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
So the Leaving Cert exam begins this morning, 9:30, English Paper 1. Over 60,000 students will either sit the exam, opt for accredited grades, or do both. Best of luck to everyone doing it this year. Let's go live to Ballantyre Community School in County Dublin and join our reporter Cillian Sherlock. Cillian.
Thanks, Audrey. Yes, anticipation is building here at Ballantyre Community School and indeed at schools around the country. Staff have been welcoming students in already, but the papers are indeed still locked away as the exams don't kick off until just under an hour's time, with English Paper 1 at 9:30. In a moment, we'll be speaking to the school's deputy principal. But before that, our reporter Una Kelly has been speaking to Leaving Cert students in Raheny about how they've been preparing for the exams.
My name is Kate Brogan and I'm a sixth-year student at Art School of Sal in Raheny. I feel a little bit nervous, but I'm a bit more relaxed because we know that we have the accredited grades as a backup if the exam doesn't go in our favour.
How did you find studying at home?
I found it quite hard to study at home because it wasn't the same as sitting in a classroom with your friends around. You couldn't ask for help off the teacher as easily, and it was very hard to motivate yourself while staring at a computer screen all day long. I'm hoping to study Irish and maths, and I want to become a secondary school teacher. I can't wait for it all to be over and to just move on and start something new in September.
My name is Lisa Lucky and I'm a sixth-year student at Art School of Sal Raheny. I'm feeling a little stressed and nervous, and I think that is normal, you know, despite any year, like even without COVID, it's supposed to be a stressful year. But I feel a little bit calm in a sense because I have the opportunity to get predicted grades and I can actually go forth with subjects I feel as though I can excel in.
What was it like trying to study at home?
It was really, really difficult. Like, I have a lot of people in my family, so, you know, I had to try my best to kind of go to a secluded area and try to study. And it was really, really difficult because a lot of it came from, like, self-motivation and kind of discipline. But I think it has definitely made me a lot more resilient because I'm able to do that for myself now. And, you know, I don't have to get someone to do it for me. So I think it has developed me somewhat as a person.
And those feelings of nervousness and attempts to focus the mind are definitely underway here at Ballantyre Community School as students continue to arrive. I'm joined by Deputy Principal Sean McGagey, who's going to tell us a little bit about the challenges that these students have faced since March of last year.
Good morning. We have over 70 students going to sit the Leaving Cert this morning, and at least every student would probably be going to sit one paper this year, so we'd be expecting up to 60% of students to turn up this morning for their English paper. And students have been very responsible in their decision making throughout the year, looking at all options open to them. Those who were selected to sit the exams have used their time wisely and sensibly to focus all their studies and efforts on the subjects and prove themselves in their written papers this morning. The exams themselves are offering greater scope and choice this year and flexibility to students, and this has probably given students more confidence in their ability to achieve better grades in their papers, particularly in the likes of English and maths, where they have more options this year in their subjects other years, and this has probably provided a bit of comfort to them to improve their results possibly.
Something else that will be providing them comfort is the option of accredited grades. Can you talk me through some of the decisions that students have been making when it comes to that?
Well, I suppose students have been looking at the best possible scenario for themselves. You know, they've looked at when they sit the exams, the time allotted has still the same, but the options have been increased a lot more in the papers, as I've mentioned. The English and the maths would be particularly dominant in that, where they have more of a scope to pick up different subjects or different topics in the area, so that would give them definitely a greater emphasis or greater possibility of improving their grades.
And can you tell me a bit more about the school here and some of the challenges that you've faced with remote working?
Well, it's been a very tough year for all the students, and All of our students have engaged very positively with the approach during lockdown. We had a blended approach here. We had a mixture of live lessons, pre-recorded lessons, and there were still difficulties, but students found the balance of the live lessons very good. There was issues throughout the country, and we were no different here in Ballantyre with Wi-Fi and laptop issues, but the disruption was overcome fairly well by the students. And I suppose the main thing the students would have missed would have been their peer-to-peer group and their social interactions with the students every day. But they adapted very well and showed great resolve and grit in coming through this, and we're very proud of them.
Deputy Principal Sean McGagey, thanks for your time, and best of luck to all the students here at Ballantyre Community School and, of course, throughout the country. Audrey.
Killian, thanks a million. Killian Sherlock reporting live there from Ballantyre Community School in County Dublin.
As the country slowly reopens from months of COVID-19 restrictions, many services are being made available again. Among them are driving lessons and tests. According to the Road Safety Authority, there are currently 120,000 people booked to take their driver theory test. There can also be long waits for lessons. 23-year-old Katie Reedy from Castle Island in County Kerry spoke to our reporter Fiacra O'Kioni about the impact of the driving lessons shutdown.
So I applied for lessons back in August, and I was waiting until December to get my first lesson because there was such a delay. And I had two or three done before the lockdown hit. I was waiting until May then to get any more lessons in. So I've been waiting a really long time. It's a nightmare trying to apply for jobs now, because obviously I don't have transport to get there. Living out in Kerry, you know, there's not much transport. So I've only 6 lessons done, and I'm only being offered 1 lesson a week. So I'm looking at another, 2 months at best, and then I'm going to have to wait another, God knows how long, at least a few weeks for a test. So that's a worry as well.
How big an impact is that going to be for you?
It's huge, because like I said, I've finished my job now. I was only contracted until May. So now I have to find a job for the summer, and it was either find a job in my hometown, and jobs are scarce, it's a small town, or alternatively find a work from home job, which is going to be difficult because there's a few other children in the family. It's not a very quiet household, but I had no other option. So it's huge. It has really had a huge impact on me.
What would you like to see happen in addition to what's already happened? Is there a need for prioritization of certain parts of the country?
Yeah, if they were to prioritise, rural areas, I think definitely, because, in bigger cities or bigger towns, there's more transport. But in Kerry, there's really nothing. You really are stuck. I'm in Castle Island, and before, for years, they've had lessons available from Castle Island. But then since COVID hit, they've only been offering them from Tralee or Killarney. And Tralee is at least a 20-minute drive for me, because I'm a bit outside the town of Castle Island. And Killarney then is 30, 35 minutes. So Killarney really is a no-go. So Tralee is the only option. Everyone from all the rural towns in Kerry, it's those two that they would have to go to. So there's a huge list.
And that was Katie Reedy from County Kerry speaking to our reporter Fiacra O'Kioni. Joining us now is Brendan Morgan. He's an approved driving instructor with the Irish School of Motoring. Good morning, Brendan, and thanks for talking to us.
Morning, Rachel.
How busy are the phones at the moment? Are you in demand?
Yeah, the phone is extremely busy at the moment. There's an absolutely huge demand for driving lessons, as you can imagine. There's no shortage of business at the minute.
And if somebody contacts you now, how long is the wait likely to be before they can get that lesson?
Well, at the moment, we are only allowed to give lessons to essential drivers, who are essential workers. So that has put some level of kind of normality on it. You have some level of order in the lessons that are being given out. But I think it's only a matter of time, and it's only right that the people who are non-essential workers will be able to do lessons very shortly. And there's going to be, quite a demand then when they come on board as well. It depends on their availability and on our availability, but we try and accommodate them within a couple of weeks anyway, if we can. But it depends, as I say, on the availability on both our sides.
Have there been any lessons then over the past 5 months?
Well, when we had a brief reprieve over Christmas time, mm-hmm. about 3 weeks, where we were given lessons, but then we went straight into lockdown again. And the only lessons that we were allowed to give at that stage was to essential workers who had a test date booked. Now, that's a very, very small, you know, window of people that we were allowed to work with. So there's been very few lessons given. We're back up and running since the 10th of May. So we're given lessons at a very good rate since then. But as I say, we have a long way to go and some things kind of normalise.
What have the past 15 months been like for you? I mean, presumably there have been long periods where basically there's been nothing to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly we're very restricted on what we can do, and there's been long periods where we had nothing to do at all. Yeah, so it's been tough and it's been frustrating, but we're trying to come back at this stage and give the best service we can. We're in an industry now where nobody is pointing the finger at anybody, saying that anybody is to blame. It's a COVID situation that's created this in some way. So what we, you know, it's incumbent on all of us now to get together and try and give the best service we can to the learners at this stage.
And you're still talking, I suppose, about a situation where many people getting into the car won't be vaccinated. Do you have any concerns about that?
Obviously, yeah, we do have concerns. You're in very close quarters with somebody giving them a driving lesson. You're beside them in the passenger seat of the car. Now, I have been vaccinated. I've had one vaccination. I'm waiting on my second. So I suppose a lot of the instructors would be of an age where they have been vaccinated now at this stage. But yes, you're dealing with people who would have been of a much younger age group who, by and large, aren't vaccinated. So it's a concern, but we take COVID and sanitization, et cetera, very, very seriously. I have seat covers. I can wipe up the seat covers. I sanitize the steering wheel, the gear stick, anything that I would have been in contact with. I also, in Irish School of Motoring, we've been issued with a thermal thermometer. So I can take the temperature of the learner and take my own temperature as well, so that we can both agree together that we're in a good, healthy temperature range to go ahead with the lesson. We also conduct the lesson with the windows slightly open to get good air exchange in the car as well. So we're pretty proactive in COVID measures, but obviously it's a slight concern. Yeah, there's no doubt.
Mm. There's also likely to be a wait, presumably, before people can take a test. I mean, we were speaking about it on the programme a few weeks ago, the long, long wait that there can be at the moment for even the theory test.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I suppose for the theory test, there is some plans afoot to give a remote theory test, so you'd be able to do it online. I think that they're trialling that at the moment, but it's only very much in the rollout phase now. But that would be a huge advantage when it does get up and running. But yeah, people to even get their first step on the driving ladder is difficult, because they have to get the theory test done in the first place. For the driving test, I think pre-COVID, you were looking at about a waiting list of a waiting time of about 6 weeks. I think it's about now, you could be talking about 25 weeks.
God, that's extraordinary. Are there any plans, do you know, to try and do something to tackle that, to maybe find a few extra testers for a few months?
Yeah, there's 40 driving testers, I understand, just about to come on stream at this stage. And there are plans to get 40 more on stream. But I mean, even if there were three times that amount, I can still see it being early next year before anything is done. I mean, there was a suggestion that driving instructors, ADIs, could be made temporary driving testers. We have been actually examined by the RSA, so we're up to their standards. They have deemed us okay to give driving lessons, so we will be very suitable to give driving tests. That could make us temporary testers maybe for a while, and maybe try and clear the backlog. It's a suggestion. I haven't heard a reason why that couldn't be done. So something that the minister could consider.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. That was Brendan Morgan, who's an approved driving instructor with the Irish School of Motoring.
Amnesty International has accused China of committing crimes against humanity in Xinjiang province. The organisation has collected new evidence of the persecution of Muslims and says the region has become a dystopian hellscape for hundreds of thousands of Muslims subjected to mass internment and torture. Xinjiang in the northwestern region is home to the Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities. Now, before we hear from Amnesty itself, we can hear the voiced and, I warn you, distressing testimony of some of the former detainees of these internment camps. This man talks about the torture of the tiger chair.
The man was in our room for more than 2 months. He was made to sit in a tiger chair. I think the man was being punished for pushing a guard. They brought the chair into our room. They told us that if we helped him, then we would sit in the chair. It was an iron chair. His arms were cuffed and chained. His legs were chained as well. His body was tied to the back of the chair. Two cuffs were locked around his wrists and legs. A rubber thing was attached to his ribs to make the person sit up straight. He would urinate and defecate in the chair. He was in the chair for 3 nights and he died after he was taken out of the cell.
In another testimony, let's hear this man recounting how his wife was forced to have an abortion.
My wife was 7 months pregnant. The law was, if you have more than 2 kids, then you have to pay a fine, and if you can't pay, there is prison. I told them I could pay the fine. They said no. So they took her to hospital and did an abortion.
Those testimonies voiced by colleagues in the newsroom. Now, earlier I spoke to Amnesty's senior crisis advisor, Jonathan Loeb, and he told me a little bit more about the gathering of the evidence for this report.
Over the past 20 months, Amnesty has been investigating the situation in Xinjiang, both inside and outside of the internment camps. And as part of this investigation, we interviewed over 100 people, including 55 former detainees from the internment camps. And these detainees gave us a very detailed and unfortunately tragic description of what life is like inside the camps. And each one of them describes an environment in which torture is endemic, an environment in which every moment, every aspect of their day is regimented for them. They describe a ceaseless indoctrination campaign that is focused essentially on rooting out Islamic practices and Turkic Muslim ethno-cultural practices, and replacing these with sort of state-sanctioned behaviors and practices.
How many Uyghurs and other Muslims have been detained since this particular crackdown began really in 2017?
Yeah, reports indicate that hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other members of predominantly Muslim ethnic minority groups have been unlawfully detained in Xinjiang since 2017. And according to the government's own statistics, hundreds of thousands more have also been detained in prisons. The precise numbers are unknown at this point as a result of the tremendous efforts that the government has gone to trying to prevent the world from understanding what is going on in Xinjiang.
And Jonathan, what reasons does the Chinese government give for detaining people in the camps or in the prisons? Do they say they've committed a crime against the state or a crime against the individual?
The government has provided a variety of explanations about the camps and the individuals in them since 2017, initially denying the existence of the camps and subsequently referring to them as educational facilities. But despite, again, what the government has said, the camps were not designed to educate anyone under any reasonable understanding of that term. They were designed to erase people's cultural identities. Similarly, all of the 55 former detainees who Amnesty interviewed that were in these internment camps had been detained for what appears to be, by all reasonable standards, entirely lawful conduct. No one committed any internationally recognized criminal offense. They were detained because they had traveled abroad, because they had called someone abroad, or because their family member had traveled abroad or called someone abroad. Many were detained because they downloaded WhatsApp or Skype or some other foreign software application on their phone, and many were arrested for praying or for working in a mosque or having religious content on their phone. These are the types of reasons why people are sent to these camps.
You record evidence of physical as well as psychological torture. What is the Tiger Chair?
Yes. Unfortunately, torture is endemic in internment camps. Every former detainee Amnesty International interviewed was tortured or subjected to other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. These are inescapable aspects of life in the internment camps. The report divides the torture that occurs in these camps into two broad categories. The first is the physical and non-physical torture that all detainees experience as a result of the cumulative effects of daily life in the camps. The second category is the physical torture that specific detainees, and Amnesty interviewed 17 or 18 former detainees who were punished during interrogations and as punishments. And these interrogations often take place in what is known as tiger chairs. Tiger chairs are steel metal chairs where a detainee's arms and legs are affixed to the chair such that they are entirely immobilized. And detainees are made oftentimes to sit in these chairs for 24 hours at a time. And often they are interrogated and otherwise physically beaten while immobilized in these chairs.
Do all detainees eventually get released from these camps, or what does one have to do to obtain your freedom?
Yeah. The process of being released from an internment camp is unfortunately not well understood, even by the detainees themselves. We do know that many detainees have been released from camps. The 55 detainees we interviewed spent, for the most part, between 9 and 18 months in one or two camps before being released. We do know that many people still remain arbitrarily detained inside Xinjiang. We also know that some people have been transferred from internment camps to prisons, and others have been transferred from internment camps to situations where they are made to do labor.
And you were listening there to Amnesty Senior Crisis Advisor Jonathan Loeb.
US President Joe Biden meets UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson today ahead of the G7 summit. And one item that will certainly be on the agenda is Brexit. Ahead of that meeting, the London Times reports this morning an extraordinary diplomatic rebuke delivered by Washington to Downing Street last week, accusing the UK of inflaming tensions with Ireland and the EU over the Northern Ireland Protocol. Oliver Wright is policy editor with The Times. He's been telling Lisa Pereira what happened.
Well, it appears to be a fairly extraordinary meeting. We've only got the UK side of it, but the chargé d'affaires in the embassy, Yael Lampert, appears to have demanded a meeting with Lord Frost to deliver something called a démarche, which is a sort of technical diplomatic term, which is basically translated as a reprimand. This is something that comes not from her in particular, but from the American administration. And she went to see Lord Frost in his office in Whitehall and read out a formal démarche to him, expressing the administration's deep concern about the way in which the UK was operating in terms of Brexit and Northern Ireland border.
And the language used in that démarche, is that something that you would normally expect between allies?
No, I mean, entirely not. And you wouldn't expect one ally to issue a démarche to another. This is much more typically seen in the case of, you know, countries such as China. I guess the best way to see it is, you know, you hear these stories about a government sort of hauling in the ambassador from another country. This is the sort of opposite of that. This is where the ambassador goes to see the government. But it's a very similar thing in diplomatic terms.
And when did this meeting happen?
This meeting happened last week. The memo that we've got hold of is dated the 4th of June. It's written by the principal private secretary to Lord Frost, and it refers to the meeting having happened the day before that. So clearly this was a memo that was sent out around Whitehall to explain what had happened.
And it's clear from the memo that these words came directly from Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase is that it says that the US was a long time interested and observer in the peace process, Lempert said, and would remain so, which is why she had been asked to deliver her first formal démarche, notable in itself, she suggested. And then she adds, to ensure clarity of her message, she slowly and gravely read her instructions aloud.
So what does this indicate then about how the meeting will go today between President Biden and Prime Minister Johnson?
I think it shows the strength of feeling on the issue from Biden. But I think there's a nuance here. I think that Biden is not particularly impressed by the way in which the UK has behaved, but neither do I think he is particularly impressed by the way in which the EU is behaving. I mean, there is, you know, in the depths of this, quite a bit around the European Union needing to make compromises on its issues, as well as the Brits having to make compromises on theirs. And I think this is an interesting line about, you know, making it clear to Johnson that, you know, if he did, for example, align UK SPS rules with those with the EU, this wouldn't negatively affect the chances of a UK-US free trade deal. So there's a bit of an olive branch in there. You know, it's the fact that this has come out isn't all bad for Downing Street, although I don't think they want it out there at all, because it will sort of try and make both sides play nicely, as it were. You don't want that kind of sense that behind the scenes Biden is really angry with Johnson. They both want this summit to be a success, so maybe in some ways getting this out there now will maybe make Biden be a little bit more cautious in what he says today.
And that was Oliver Wright, policy editor with The Times, talking to Lisa Pereira. David O'Sullivan, former EU ambassador to Washington, is on the line from Brussels. And David, a démarche, this, you know, formal reading of the statement of Washington's position last week. How big a deal is this in diplomatic circles, and how big a deal from Washington?
I think it is quite a big deal, and I think it shows the undoubted strength of feeling which we all knew President Biden and this administration would bring to the issue of Ireland and the peace process. And I think, as was being described, it is pretty unusual to see this kind of diplomatic approach between allies. And it underlines, I think, you know, the feeling also in other European countries that there is really a question mark over whether the United Kingdom is actually serious about implementing what it has signed up to in the protocol. And this is really causing quite a crisis.
And the pressure from the United States for an SBS deal, this would be a deal on animal and food products to avoid the sausage wars that are being talked about in the British media. The US saying any SBS deal with the EU wouldn't affect the trade deal with them. How big a deal is that?
Well, I think it's an important gesture by the US to say, you know, this would not take the trade deal off the agenda. To be very frank, I think there's little likelihood of a trade deal being concluded anytime soon anyway, because trade promotion authority, which is needed in the United States, expires this summer and doesn't look like being renewed. But I think it is a reassurance to the UK to say that if they were to do the sensible thing, which would actually take a lot of the difficulties out of the implementation of the protocol and sign a Swiss-type veterinary agreement with the EU, this would not damage the prospects for a future trade deal. So this is a reassurance which was being offered to the UK by the US.
The question is whether number 10 will listen, because so far all the pleas and diplomacy from Brussels and from Dublin don't appear to have changed much.
No, unfortunately. And I really think that this is a crunch moment in terms of the EU trying to decide whether this British government is ever going to be serious about implementing what it commits to in agreements. And this is going to be very damaging, because Brexit is done, but we are going to be negotiating on many issues over the next few years. And if the British government cannot be relied upon to stick to what they have committed and signed up to and ratified, then this is going to make life very difficult indeed. So I think this goes beyond even the issue of important though it is, of the Northern Ireland Protocol and the peace process. It goes to the core of the credibility of this British government as an international negotiator.
Why is the issue of checks on chilled meats, this, you know, the checks on the British sausage that is being made such a big deal of in England at the moment, why does that matter so much to the EU that they're willing to have a trade dispute over it?
Well, the point is, Anya, that the import into the European Union from third countries of chilled meat, mincemeat, sausages is not allowed because it is thought to be extremely difficult to be certain of the provenance. And this is banned unless there is an agreement such as we have, for example, with Switzerland, where there is a commitment to meet the EU standards. This was a known consequence of Brexit. This is not a surprise. The British government itself notified producers that they would not be able to export these products. Now, there is a solution, which is the veterinary agreement, but this is treating the United Kingdom in the way it wished to be treated as, which is as a third country, non-member of the EU.
One other thing, of course, that's going to feature on the agenda of the G7, and besides that, Joe Biden will also be meeting NATO and the EU, but it's the issue of COVID and the vaccine gap in particular between rich and poor nations. You've got more than half the populations in the UK and the US vaccinated at this stage, for instance, and fewer than 2% in Africa. Can we expect a big announcement from Joe Biden?
Well, he has already, I think, announced that the United States will purchase for distribution some 500 million doses. The European Union has been in the lead on this for some time, very supportive of the COVAX initiative, has already given quite a lot of money and has made clear, I think, in various statements, that we too want to join with the developed countries in helping the less developed countries get the vaccines that they need, because this really is true that until everyone is safe, none of us are safe, and we do need to help the poorer countries also put in place a vaccine program to try and eliminate this virus globally.
And the other issue, diplomats will be watching closely US-Russia relations.
Yes, well, I mean, this is a very important trip for President Biden, and it's been carefully choreographed. He goes to the UK and the G7 now, then he comes to NATO, then he meets with the EU, and then he meets Mr. Putin in Geneva. This is clearly designed to set up a situation where, as the president likes to say, America is back, cooperating with its allies, coordinating with them, and he goes into his meeting with Mr. Putin with the full support of his Western allies in those discussions, and I think that will put him in a much stronger position than might otherwise have been the case.
Thank you for your time this morning, David O'Sullivan, there, former EU ambassador to Washington.
Another member of the DUP has resigned. Roberta McNally, a member of the party in Upper Ban in County Down, has become the latest member to quit following the election of Edwin Poots as leader last month. Her decision followed the resignations of two councillors in South Down, Catherine Owen and Glyn Hanna. And Mr. Hanna is on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
And you're very welcome to the programme. You've been in the DUP a long time. Why did you decide to resign?
Well, to be quite honest, over the last year or so, I was very, very concerned about the direction the DUP was taking. And what really brought it to a head was the last 4 or 5 weeks with the removal and the way Arlene Foster was removed as DUP leader. Then after that, the way the Poots camp conducted their election campaign for leader of the DUP. And following on from that, whenever it came to the ratification meeting on the 27th of May, the behaviour of that was disgraceful. And then following on from that, the behaviour of the South Down DUP MLA, John Wells, sending out emails directing what we should do in South Down, at the Democratic Unionist Party is supposed to be democratic. Everybody's entitled to a different view. So last weekend it came to a head so that we had to have an AGM for legal purposes, and at that meeting, the meeting was just support with Poots, swamped with supporters of Poots and Wells. Fair enough, I was removed. I accept that. I was removed by one vote as the South Down DUP chairman. We are where we are. When I reflected on it the next day, I just decided, along with nearly the biggest part of the South Down DUP Association, we all decided to resign. What has happened in the South Down DUP Association is basically all the young people have gone with me, and I don't know what they're hoping to achieve. The possibility of Jim Wells and his supporters have won a small victory, so they have, but have definitely lost the war in South Down.
Well, you have described it as a purge, and indeed in a statement yesterday, Geoffrey Donaldson, who it says you and he have been lifelong friends, you've known each other since you were children, he also described it as a purge, and he said that your treatment and that of the South Down Association was an absolute disgrace. Is it not the case, though, in politics, that the new leader, they want their own supporters in various positions rather than someone like you who backed the opponent, Geoffrey Donaldson, in this case?
Well, fair enough. That is possibly the way of it. Look at the leadership contest. It ended up in 1917, so it did. Glaringly obvious. Mm-hmm. There's a huge split in the DUP. Well, from those who wish to follow Edmund Pitts to the hard right, and those like myself that want to sit in the middle and be as appealing to as many people as possible, I would be very of a centrist, moderate type perspective. So I would. So if that's what he wants to do, I can't do anything about it. But just on the meeting we had on the 27th, pretty much my daughter Deanne, who had stood for the DUP in South Down here and got the largest ever unionist vote since Enoch Powell was in South Down, we reflect what a lot of people want. My daughter Deanne at that meeting on the 27th did stand up and make a speech. She was disrespected at it. One lady actually who stood up from South Belfast and said that she was a founding member of the DUP. Now, I don't know in the south of Ireland where you will understand this remark, but she turned around and she said she didn't really know what that girl was talking about. That was my daughter Deanne, I think, wasn't even drying her rent book. So, you know, how disrespectful. And that was very, very mild compared to some of the remarks that were made about my daughter. So, but even at that, at a personal level, above and beyond that, we have to be all-inclusive. I don't believe I'm going to be included in anything, so I don't. And I do believe those from South Down, all the executive members have been removed. All the officers that supported Arling Foster and Geoffrey Donaldson have been removed.
Okay, so, well, let's hear from Edwin Poots, Mr. Hannah, because you mentioned your daughter there and she resigned as well. Edwin Poots, he's been discussing these departures as part of a BBC Spotlight programme, which is going to be broadcast tonight. Let's hear what he has to say.
Okay. I think it is peripheral, but nonetheless, I don't want to lose anybody from the party. And therefore, I will be continuing to reach out to people to seek to ensure that we keep as many people as possible and to bring new people into the party.
And Geoffrey Donaldson, in his statement, says that he fears that if Edwin Poots fails to quickly get a grip of this situation, then many others may also conclude that the DUP is no longer capable of being a broad church and providing a home for the type of unionism that we espouse. Do you worry that a split is looming in the party?
Well, I'm not worrying that there's going to be a split in the party. There is a split in the party, so there is. You know, it's a matter of Edmund and them there to keep harping on this, that it's not there. It is there. And I know Roberta McNally, at that meeting on the 27th, Roberta was sitting in the row in front of me in the room, and I tell you, she was sitting holding her head, so she was. Long-standing members like Roberta, hard-working members like Roberta, to be quite honest with you, you can't afford to lose them in any political party, so you couldn't. So I don't know where Edmund's coming from. And he calls me peripheral. I think that's not the word he used.
Yeah.
Put it this way. I became chairman of the South Down Association, which was in a very, very poor state about 5, maybe even 6 years ago. We along with me, myself, Deanne, Richard McKee, a number of others all sat down and we rebuilt the party, so we did. We rebuilt it to a stage, so we did, that we've had two massive elections, and the last council election, so we did there, I topped the polls, so I did a quadrupled what the previous outgoing DUP councillor had done. We got to a stage, so we did there, where we were very, very, very good position. Now what has happened is Mr. Wells and the supporters have taken them back at least 10, 15 years, so they have. And I honestly think Mr. Wells will get a massive shock if he's allowed to stand for the DUP in South Down.
Okay.
He'll be slaughtered. I believe he'll be slaughtered.
Well, we shall wait and see. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Glyn Hannah, former member of the DUP, former councillor for the DUP, now sitting as an independent. Thank you very much indeed.
The High Court in Belfast has cleared the way for a judicial review of the Northern Ireland Executive's continued failure to implement an Irish language strategy. An Irish language strategy was agreed as part of the St Andrews deal back in 2006. In 2017, a court ruled the executive had failed in its legal duty to adopt the strategy. A commitment was also included in the 2020 New Decade, New Approach deal. Cathaoirleach Moody is advocacy manager with Conradh na Gaeilge. Cathaoirleach, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
I wonder why now? Why do you feel the need to go back to the High Court to renew judicial review proceedings at this time? You have the commitment from 2020 in the New Decade, New Approach document.
Yeah, no, Mary, I think it's pretty important to mention that the context of this was that over 15 years ago, the commitment was made in St Andrews. And then in 2020, following the New Decade, New Approach, there was a recommitment to develop a comprehensive timeline within 3 months, and then to adopt an Irish language strategy within 6 months. Now, that has surpassed that, and those commitments are still outstanding at the moment. However, we are seeing progression on other policies. And to be honest, court is our last resort. We have sought assurances. We have met with officials in many of the executive departments and ministers. And we believe now that this is being held up politically and blocked within the executive office. So we sent a pre-action protocol letter to the executive office. They had a 28 days to respond to us, which is a statutory duty to respond, and they're currently haven't responded. So we now have sought leave, and the High Court has granted leave, and we are assumed to be going to court on in September 2021. It is worth mentioning that Mr. Justice Schofield decided that the case for the executive in relation to the current strategy comfortably submits the threshold for leave. And this is 4 years after our previous High Court ruling on the executive's failure to implement an Irish language strategy.
So, from your point of view and your strategy, is this about piling on the pressure or keeping the pressure going? Because you have a commitment, haven't you, from Edwin Poots, the new DUP leader, who's saying that he has pledged to legislate and fulfil commitments under the New Decade, New Approach, including commitments to the Irish language. And you have Michelle O'Neill talking about looking for commitments when, you know, there will be talks about re-engaging now for the election of First and Deputy First Minister with the incoming nominee Paul Given. So do you need to have the court issue at this stage? There are other pressures being brought to bear.
Well, I think it's important that last year the institutions were re-established on the basis of the implementation of the New Decade, New Approach, and all parties, including the DUP, signed up to that, and all its parts, including both the British government and Irish government. Now, the Irish language community, and I would imagine the general public, fully expect all parties to implement that agreement. Now, we're 500 days on from the signing of the New Decade, New Approach, and we're yet to see any serious movement on any of the core components of the legislation or the Irish language strategy. And to be honest, what we're actually experiencing is that the executive office, where the DUP minister sits and has the authorities, is that it isn't being progressed. And it's important to mention that the preparatory work around the strategy has undertaken. It sits with the Department of Communities, and it has to be agreed by the executive. So it hasn't featured on the executive agenda. And the only reason for that is because of political frustration and political blockage. Oh, right. So you're right. We do not want to go to court. We wish we couldn't go to court. And there is a solution to this. There is an executive meeting today. There is an executive meeting next Thursday where they could agree to the timetable for an Irish language strategy. And you're right, there is also a solution to the current crisis in terms of Irish language implementation of the legislation, is that those the preparatory work and the legislation has been published for over 500 days.
Okay.
So there's no reason for the delay, and there's no reason for excuses. So the time is now for the implementation of that legislation and the commitments made in New Decade, New Approach.
Cathaoirleach, thank you for joining us this morning. Cathaoirleach Moody, their advocacy manager with Conradh na Gaeilge.
The Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has said he'll fly to space with his brother on the first human flight launched by his space company Blue Origin. Bezos, one of the world's richest men, said it was something he had always wanted to do. Space commentator Leo Enright is on the line. Leo, is this a very, very rich man indulging his dreams, or is there a greater purpose to this flight?
Well, all of the billionaires, Rachel, and there are several of them involved in this business of space now, maintain that they have a grand vision of humans living and working in space routinely. And that's certainly been the dream of many space pioneers in the past. But the immediate opportunities here are for the very, very rich, I'm afraid.
Where will the Bezos brothers be going then, and how?
Well, they won't be going very far. They will simply be going up and down, rather like in a lift in a building. Only they'll be going to what they call the Van Karman line, 100 kilometers above the Earth. The whole flight will take just 10 minutes from start to finish. And the only requirement they have for the people flying in this spaceship, you don't have to be Superman or Superwoman. The only requirement is that you're able to climb 90 steps of stairs and not need to go to the bathroom for 90 minutes.
And on this 10-minute flight, I mean, what will they be able to see? What will they be able to do?
Well, I'll be honest with you, Rachel. I do think there is there's a special offer, as it were, with this Bezos spacecraft. It's not the only one, as we know. Richard Branson is flogging an entirely different system. But what is really unique about Blue Origin's offering is the size of the windows. Up to 6 people can sit inside this capsule, and the windows really are extraordinarily large. Much bigger than aircraft windows. We've seen they've flown more than a dozen times without people, and each one has been broadcast live by the company, in fairness to them. And the views really have been extraordinary through these huge panoramic windows.
You mentioned the fact that there are other billionaires who want to go to space. Is there a bit of one-upmanship here among billionaires?
Yeah, you do have to wonder, Rachel. Bezos made this announcement. He's under a lot of pressure. He set up this company way back in the year 2000, which seems like an awful long time ago now. And his mission, ultimately, is to make money out of this, but he hasn't made a cent yet. He hasn't successfully launched his bigger rocket, with which he hopes to get government contracts. While all of this has been slowly progressing at Jeff Bezos's own pace, the other guy on the block, that is Elon Musk, the billionaire who invented PayPal, Elon Musk has already won huge NASA contracts to send men and women into space, to send cargo into space, and just now he's been given a contract to land humans back on the moon. So Bezos is in a hurry to catch up.
Thank you very much, Leo. Space commentator Leo Enright there.
Around 1,000 of them lie in unmarked graves in a cemetery in Leadville in Colorado, thousands of miles away from where many of them were born and raised in Southwest Ireland. They fled the famine here and travelled to America in search of a better life. But like so many others, that dream did not come true and they ended up working and dying long before their time. Now a project is underway to identify those in the graves, to tell their stories and to memorialise them with grant help from the Department of Foreign Affairs. I've been hearing more from the president of the Irish Network Group in Colorado, Alan Grork.
A lot of the credit has to go to Professor Jim Walsh, who did a lot of research on this over 20 years ago as part of his doctorate. And as he was looking at the Leadville Irish, because we knew there was a lot of Irish who had come to Leadville as miners, and they came from the Beara Peninsula in West Cork predominantly, as well as some from the East Coast in the Pennsylvania mines. But as part of his research, he came across the cemetery there in Leadville, Evergreen Cemetery, and there was rows and rows of unmarked graves. And a forest now has grown up around those graves. And Jim and his students, over the last, well, the last 5 years particularly, they were able to find records on over 1,300 people buried in those graves, and that 70% of them were Irish. And the average age they have found when their research was 23 years old, and half of them were children. And so, you know, this brought to attention to the Irish community here that, you know, there was a struggle going on up there, and what went wrong, you know, or what happened here. So about 5 years ago, we held a commemoration at the site, and that's when it first came to my attention as part of, I'm president of Irish Network Colorado. And so we, at the commemoration, we had the Irish consulate from Austin there and a number of other dignitaries. And this is just a surreal and somber place. There was a woman there that day from Denver who sat in a chair with just a guitar, and she sang a beautiful rendition of Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears. Just to be there to hear this with no other sound other than the breeze going through the trees, it just gave you chills. And you couldn't help to think of all those souls who perished there 140 years ago, because this was the late 19th century. They were finally being heard or recognised.
And Alan, you paint a very evocative picture there of what took place at that cemetery. And these are unmarked graves. There's no headstone. There's just a few wooden markers. And imagining these people and their journey from Ireland over 140 years ago, there was a silver boom, wasn't there, taking place in the United States. So what would working the mines have been like back then?
You probably have to picture where this all happened. This was in the city of Leadville, which is located high up in the Rocky Mountains. It's about 2 hours drive from Denver. So, you know, we here in Denver, we know it as the Mile High City, but Leadville is twice that elevation at 10,000 feet above sea level. That's three times Carntool. And it was called Cloud City back then. So yeah, in the late 19th century, there was a silver boom there. And in 1880, actually, out of a population of 30,000 people living in Leadville, 3,000 of them were Irish born. So it was the largest Irish community in the western United States outside of California. But the working conditions, I mean, the Irish, they occupied the bottom rung of the ladder in Leadville. And, you know, they came over, like what we have found, that the mines in Alahees in the Beira Peninsula, they were struggling and were shutting down at just after the famine. And so they all came, and I suppose once a few people trickled, a lot more came to Leadville. But the conditions were very harsh. I think in the mines, in the bottom of the mines, it was up to 130 degrees Fahrenheit, and above ground in the winter time, minus 20. So they say that a lot of the reasons behind how many children died so young was due to scarlet fever and typhoid, which were also happening at the time. And it's also said that people were being buried at night, so the rest of the population didn't know what was going on. You know, it was a Wild West town.
And presumably, Alan, many of these people, would they still have descendants here in Ireland?
Yeah, they would. I mean, so even from Professor Walsh's research, he has found that the name, and he says it himself, the names of Harrington and Sullivan and McCarthy were as common in Leadville as they were in their native Cork. So, you know, we have, actually, that's an interesting side to this, that there's a twinning in the works between the city of Leadville and Alahees on the Beira Peninsula. There is the Copper Mining Museum in Alahees is run by Tygo Sullivan. Our plan from our end, you know, we have numbers and we have names, but we want to put stories with those. And we want to, like Tyg himself would say, that he can, when he gives the tour in Alahees, he can tell the story of what happened to those miners until they got to Cove to get on the boat, or Queenstown as it would have been. And we're trying to continue that story here. So we have reached out to them to see, can we make connections to, because people connect with stories rather than just names or stats.
Because to be forgotten is to die twice, isn't that the saying? And these people certainly have been forgotten, but you are now giving them a voice once again.
Yeah, I mean, we feel that, like, these are a forgotten Irish people. There's many, you know, people hear about the Irish Americans who succeeded. But these Irish people came to America, came to Colorado, came to Leadville in search of a better life, but were exposed to just a harsh existence, really, and they died trying to find an American dream, you know? And it was a dead end of a life to come from a out of the children of the famine to come over here, and this is what happened. So we don't want to forget that. And so if I'm given the opportunity to honor these people, and really the essence is to name the unnamed.
And that was the president of the Irish Network in Colorado, Alan Grork.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.